good morning, eaters, diners, travelers.
That was
all over the world.
Yeah. There was a little pause there.
Yeah, she's there was a little pause because
Anne's off to a really good start this morning.
So, and you're listening to On the Menu with Anne and Peter Haig. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Yes, and we have our first, the one who's giggling in the background is this world famous chef, Terry Rotero, who is, he's just won every award in the book, and he has a fabulous sense of humor, and he's going to join us in a lot of fun this morning.
Good morning, Anne. Good morning, Peter.
Yes.
Now, let's get this out of the way first. What's with this hat?
Yeah, what's with the hat? Well, you know, when you're not cute enough in life, you got to figure out some shtick.
You're cute, Terry.
No, I'm just kidding. My hat, my wife bought me a hat for Christmas about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and I took a good liking to it, and first I was wearing it everywhere in the kitchen, but never in the dining room, and one day I forgot I had it on my head. So I came out in the dining room, and one of my customers looked at me and went, "Oh, the chef in the hat," and I went, "Oops, marketing.
Yeah, there you go.
So I trademarked the name, and it's been the chef in the hat ever since.
Oh, so yes. You actually have a trademark on the name.
Yes. Oh, yes.
So, and listeners, the new cookbook out is called Rovers, which is the name of Terry's restaurant in Seattle.
Right.
And is subtitled Recipes from Seattle's Chef in the Hat.
That's right.
And I should mention that this book is available on our website, www.onthemenuradio.com, where we also list all kinds of things that we're doing. And
but in order
and
to buy it, you go to the button called OTM Bookshelf, and you should get a copy because these recipes are absolutely
fascinating and delicious,
and the photographs look good enough to eat.
My co-writer Cynthia Nim and I, especially Cynthia, who did all the retrying at home. On the gas stove.
I know she did home. She tested it at home.
Oh, the recipe was tested twice.
Wow.
And to make sure they would work in the house, in a home setting.
Right.
And I was very impressed. And, almost none of them needed tweaking. It was just, it was working fine.
And that's amazing because usually what happens is the temperature is the real thief of these recipes because
right. The
home cooks' ovens just aren't the same.
Right. Well, she had a decent oven, a decent stove, and it worked out really well, and there was very little tweaking to do, and things came out really good. It's very funny. I mean, it's very interesting. It was an interesting experience for me to, we'd get in, Cynthia would come to the restaurant, I'd go, okay, let's, this is what I just got at the market, or this is what I got from the farm today, from the farmers, and I said, okay, we're going to cook. She goes, what are you going to make? I said, well, I don't know yet. And, let's see what we have. So I'd put everything on the table and in the kitchen here at Rovers. And I'd go, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. We'd have a protein of some kind. So it was a very interesting experience to make. It was quite interesting to know that you'd making a recipe like this, like I always do, and then it would be retransferred into a home kitchen and actually work.
So you would have planned out in advance that you were going to have Scottish woodcock or wild salmon from off the coast of Seattle or something like that. You don't really have that figured out.
Yeah, it wasn't planned ahead, like days ahead. It was like whatever's coming from the farm today, let's say it's Monday, whatever comes today from the farm is something I would use because that's seasonal, local, and right here, and that's what I wanted to do the book. I wanted a whole year to do the book, to go through all the season, and then see what the availability of produce is and fruits and everything throughout the whole year here in Seattle.
Well, you're perfectly situated with it's just such a generous pantry of fabulous foods in the Pacific Northwest.
Right. We have the Garden of Eden here.
Now, how did you get there? You were born in France. What part of France?
Just below Nantes, below the Loire River, at the end of the Loire Valley.
Yes, exactly.
It's a beautiful section of France.
Yes, it's gorgeous. Very, small farms, lots of chateaus, it's pretty picturesque countryside. Definitely very nice. 30 miles from the ocean, nice maritime kind of weather inland. So, very, very rich. And I started an apprenticeship for 2 years when I was 14 in Cholet, in Anjou, in the Anjou region of France. Then I went to the Mont-Saint-Michel, Chamonix in the Alps.
Oh, wow.
Saint-Jean-de-Luz in the Basque country.
Oh, that would have been interesting.
Oh, yeah, that was very interesting to do all those regional differences. That was pretty interesting.
And so you always knew you were going to be a chef?
No. I was, actually, the first 3 years, I hated it.
Really? So why did you
do
it?
I was treated very poorly as an apprentice.
Well, that's what happens, isn't it? It's sort of death. I mean, it's sort of, you're thrown into the cauldron, and if you manage to last, then you last.
Right, but, I have promised myself I would never treat people like that in my life.
Okay. You don't seem like you. I told you, I keep running into people, interviewing people. All of them have worked with you, and they all love you.
But you still haven't explained how you got from various
parts
of France.
Then I went to Orléans, and then I did a year of army time. You have to do army time in France. Uh-huh. Back then you did. You don't have any more to do that. And then after that, I said, I was looking for a job, and there was a little ad in the local paper saying, looking for cook in USA. It didn't even say where.
Oh,
I said,
really?
Oh, let me try that. My mom was laughing. She's like, yeah, right. Well, 3 weeks, 4 weeks later, I was in Chicago.
Really?
Intended to come to the States. Never thought about it before. I just did, I just did that and came right into Chicago. Found the person who brought me was a complete joke. It didn't work out. But 3 months later, I ended up in a great restaurant, La Fontaine, in Chicago. And we had a great team there of people. Worked there for 3 years and then moved on to Los Angeles. And then in Los Angeles, I worked with, my first job was with Joachim Splichal.
Oh, really?
And then,
Did he have twins? Is he the one who just wrote the,
he has twins.
He and his wife wrote a book on feeding baby.
Right.
Okay. Now we're not going to talk about overstaying visas or anything like that here, are we? But it seems to me that Daniel Ballou had a very similar story.
Well, I think pretty much all chef immigrants have the same kind of story because that's how you get here in the first place. Some of them have wanted to come here forever. I've never even thought about it. I just, like I said. Oh yeah, that'd be interesting. Let me go to the States for 6 months, make some money, and come back.
Okay.
Well, that was 29 years ago.
Yeah, here you are, right?
Kind of slow on the release.
Yes.
Now, what's it like to have the same first name as one of the most famous sportsmen on the planet?
He's a very lucky man.
He's a very lucky man. There you go. Yeah,
imagine if his name was Jacques. I mean, come on.
Jacques Henri.
That wouldn't be the same.
We're talking, of course, listeners, about Thierry Henry, who is probably the second or third most famous soccer player of all time.
That is right.
Who happens to be a Frenchman, but he plays the soccer
for the English
club of Arsenal, but he did help France to win the World Cup when the World Cup was in France.
That is correct.
So he's a national hero forever, a national treasure forever.
That's right, and he's a very great player.
Yeah, he is that too. He's one of those players who does unbelievable things. I was telling Anne a little bit ago. There's an ad out somewhere. Now with Roger Federer, Tiger Woods, and Thierry Henry. And he's the one that most Americans wouldn't recognize, except that they know he's not Tiger Woods and they know he's not Roger Federer. they're probably wondering why he's in the ad.
What's the ad for?
I think it's Nike, but I'm really not sure.
Yeah, well, we said if you can't remember the product, that makes it a
It's a really good ad.
Something went wrong. The staff took over the ad.
Yeah, I was one of the 2 out of 100 people who actually knew who he was when he came on without him having to be introduced. but anyway, let's go back to the wonderful
Thierry,
world of cooking.
How did you get to Seattle then?
So after Los Angeles, I work with Joachim, and then I work at the 7th Street Bistro with a chef named Laurent Quenu, a French guy, and very talented man. And I totally exploded my art liking in that position. Really, really, this was the revelation where I was like, okay, this is what I want to do. This is really what I want to do because I know there's a way for me to get my yahoos out. Mm-hmm. So after 3.5 years, we came to Seattle with my wife to see a friend a couple of times. And the last time we came to this little restaurant called Rovers that was 10 months old, just got a review in the LA Times. It was a little house, and we came for dinner, and turns out to be that it was for sale. So I'm like, hello, this is my ticket out of Los Angeles. We wanted to get out of Los Angeles.
Yeah, I can't picture you in Los Angeles.
Well, it was a fun time, In 5 years, I was the first 3 years was fun. The last 2 years was how do we get out?
Yes.
Yeah. That's a fabulous. So it's sort of just like an accident that, that you showed up there.
Actually, I believe in karma very strongly. So I think that's just fate. You know, it's just the way life works.
And so you opened Rovers how long ago then?
20 and a half years ago.
Well, Rovers was open.
It was
right?
Oh, it was open. Basically, when we purchased the restaurant, it was a year old. So the gentleman who owned it, Kevin McKenzie, was the prior owner and wanted to go back to Los Angeles. He was originally from there.
Okay, now, so you did a swap.
We didn't do a swap. We just, we kind of did a swap. I moved up and he moved down.
There you
and,
go.
And, you know, from then on, it was history. You know, I had a partner and bought her out after 3 years and then it's been running solo ever since.
Now, is this your first cookbook?
That's my first cookbook. I've been in many, many, many cookbooks, but I have never had my own cookbook, and this is my first cookbook, yes.
And you were saying how much fun it was that all these recipes have been tested by your writer, Cynthia Nims, for the home cook, on a home range and everything.
Every recipe was retried twice at home, and they all worked. They all been tested, and she's extremely thorough and very... She has a huge background, a huge culinary background from La Varenne Cooking School and many, many years of experience in the kitchen. So she was extremely thorough and, you know, which is what a mad chef like me needs.
There you go. So you
keep the track together.
So as well as the hat.
Exactly.
You admit to a certain amount of, shall we say, mental abstraction?
Well, not everyone, actually almost no one is good at everything. You know, there's always something you're not as good at, and you're supposed to know who's going to be good at it and work with them.
All right. Now, what would our listeners find if they went to your restaurant? Would they find these kinds of recipes?
Yes. They would find this kind of cooking.
And what is your style of cooking?
My style of cooking is based on, well, French tradition, because I was raised in, trained in France. But, however, it's all contemporary style. I don't use any thickeners in my food or any, you know, even though I was raised with a roux and all that, I don't use any of that stuff. Everything is done by reduction. I'm a strong flavor man. I like flavors.
Yeah. Well, Daniel Boulou, Chef Boulou, says that your food is a celebration of the Northwest served up with a French accent.
Exactly.
Well, I couldn't have said it better. Now, how would you describe his? This is probably the same with a New York accent.
I would say exactly. I would say then Daniel he's got that Lyonnaise style of food that's so beautiful, rich and deep.
Right.
And yet he has a very elegant hand on everything he touches.
Yeah, so, he's also a wonderful guy. We've been to we've been to every one of his restaurants in New York except the one that just opened. And he's almost taking a leaf out of your book, because before we came on the air, you were telling us that you make all your own charcuterie,
everything.
You make your own bacon, you love pork belly like everybody does.
Yes, and actually, you know Lynn Rosetta Casper?
Yes.
Who's on NPR?
The Splendid Table, yes.
Yeah, she's also in endorsing the book in the back. But she, one time Lynn was here and I said, she was on her way out, she says, okay, I got to have dessert. And I said, oh, my God, Lynn, I forgot to give you. I just baked that pork belly for you, and I forgot to give it to you. She goes, okay, I'll have it now after dessert. She said, oh, my God, that was the best dessert I have ever had.
She likes the same kind of desserts as Anne does.
Yes.
Yeah, Anne would have something savory for dessert at all costs.
Now, what are Kushi oysters?
Vancouver Southwest. Vancouver Island in the southeast part of the island, right next to Stella Bay.
Okay, so they're from just slightly north of the wonderful oyster beds around Seattle.
Right, they're part of the San Juan Island oyster. Oh,
okay, all right. We associate oysters from the northwest with the Hood Canal and places like that. But so
right,
this is not very far away.
It's like a stone throw across. You know, it's all that water is part of the Puget Sound.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all part of the same kind of, it's the same water, except the border happens to be in between the two.
And here's another one that looks great, the frog's legs with fava bean puree and summer black truffle.
This is one of my favorite, too. Oh, this is so
Terry,
good.
Terry, I want to come have dinner now.
Well, Anne, you need to get in the kitchen first.
Well, I think Peter's in the kitchen tonight fixing shrimp, which will be nice. Should be nice and easy to do.
Wild American shrimp.
But we still have to decide what to do with the parsnips.
You know, I've got a great shrimp recipe that is quite simple to make.
And in here? Is it in the book?
Yes, it's in the book, and it's actually spot prawn, but, you know, shrimp work fine with that. Mm-hmm. And it's towards the beginning of the book. It's an appetizer with cucumber and vodka dressing.
Oh, that sounds good.
So it's kind of like you get a little bit of your martini and your shrimp at the same time.
Wow. Boy,
drink your dinner.
I just bought a new cucumber, too, so
maybe we can
maybe we can fiddle with that. Boy, that'll be an adventure.
If you look on page 56, there's a picture of it, and, of course, I use the heads and everything, but it's got cucumber, caviar, and vodka. So you can't go really wrong with that.
Well, the only missing ingredient we have is we're fresh out of caviar. We usually keep a little Osestra in the house,
but you can always do without it. I mean,
you can always do without it.
But it's the dressing is such an easy thing to make. It's Dijon mustard, olive oil, and vodka, and ground pepper.
It's called Martini of Spot Prawns. Here it is. It looks great. Here on the next page, you've got. This lamb's tongues and Spanish white anchovies.
Yes.
And it reminds me, we have a boutique lamb producer, Jamison Farms, here.
Of course.
Yeah, they're good friends. Anyhow, Mario Batali got in touch with them. He needed 400 to 500 lamb's tongues a week.
Did somebody forget to remind him there was only one per lamb?
Yes.
Well, I mean, he must be getting it from somewhere. Now you must know his dad, right?
Of course, his dad.
In Seattle.
Yes, he's a very charming man, very very nice. He does a beautiful
charcuterie.
Yeah, I absolutely adore his lamb prosciutto.
Yeah, he does a great job on all his charcuterie. He has a store called Salumi.
Right.
And quite cute. I mean, very nice. I think Mario's got the idea of doing all this charcuterie from his dad.
Yeah, well, he has a young chef in New York who I've actually met and interviewed. He's at Otto, I think.
Yes.
But he also does all the charcuterie for all of Mario's restaurants, and he's only like 25 years old. I mean, he's an absolute master.
I have cooks in my kitchen that are younger than that who are totally immersed into that charcuterie making and all that, and it's so nice to watch. I mean, they get so into it and they love it. And once you understand the combination of the flavors and the chewing,
Peter, not to be doing it in our basement.
Yes, why not?
Oh,
yeah, I wanted to do Michael Ruhlman's recipe for duck prosciutto, and Anne said I wasn't allowed because I'd probably kill us.
Why?
Because who knows what's in our basement?
How hot is your basement?
It's exactly like the basement of a 150-year-old house would be. You have absolutely no idea what kind of flavors you might capture down there.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, you have to be careful about that a little
bit.
here in the restaurant, we use an old refrigerator that we took the motor out, and we have. We use the humidity, we calculate the humidity, you know, we have a measuring humidifier, and that's it. And then we leave the door slightly open or slightly closed, and it's nothing new.
Now, we met a young chef and his partner who were in San Diego. They had a restaurant called Region in San Diego, and they had met when they were at one of Tom Douglas's places in Seattle, and I think they went back there. His first name is Michael. I wish I could remember his last name. And he made charcuterie in a closet in his restaurant in San Diego. And it was just absolutely terrific.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all you have to do is have an environment that's got enough humidity or dryness. Depends on what you're looking for, how you're trying to get to what point you're at. And the rest is just simple. And you talk about duck prosciutto. I've been making duck prosciutto for 20 years in my restaurant with the legs the size of the moulard duck. And it's really not a complicated process, but we have an advantage in walk-in refrigerator in restaurants where there's a big fan.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Right.
And,
yeah, so,
and that's
so
the
you've
difference
got,
between
yeah.
a home refrigerator and a non-home right. refrigerator is there is circulation of air, which is what you're looking for.
Right.
Right. We were just at the Capitol Grill restaurant in Pittsburgh where the chef is an old friend of ours, and he showed us his aging room, and it has exactly as you describe it. It has very rapid air circulation of cool air so that his meat is just kept absolutely perfect. I'm going to ask you to do something really difficult now, because out of this wonderful book where every recipe is better than the one before, can you pick out a couple of your real favorites and then explain why?
Well, I was actually going through the pages right now, and I'm looking for the scrambled egg and caviar, because it's been a trademark thing here at Rovers for 20 years. And I cannot get rid of the damn thing because everybody keeps asking for it.
Uh-huh.
So it's one of those dishes that people love. They just love to see it. And it looks very pretty.
You serve it in... that's a different one.
We serve it into the eggshell.
Yeah, I was looking at that. I need to get one of those. I have the kind of egg topper that you has little teeth and you squeeze it.
No, those are not... That's not what
good.
You need.
I need
because
one
those
of these.
Are made for hard-boiled eggs.
Well, we actually use them on soft-boiled eggs. That's what we got them for.
Right. That's what they're made for. The instrument we use is something you can find on. You know J.B. Prince in New York City?
No,
the
I don't.
The company J.B. Prince?
No.
It's a great supply fancy tool for the kitchen.
Okay, all right.
Anything you need, you're going to find it there. But they have this tool that was made. Okay, now here's the perfect tool. It's invented by the French and built by the Germans. How can you go wrong with that?
And used by the Italians. No, yeah. That's another
joke. No. We don't get that. We only get them involved if we need design.
Okay. And who is it? The English or the lovers?
Right.
And the police are the Italians.
That's going wrong. So the egg topper, the way we take the egg, we take a fresh egg, and there is this instrument that sits like a bell right on top of the egg, and there's a spring release. Then you pull up and then release. And the noise, when it hits the bell, cracks the egg perfectly fine.
Oh, is that how
amazing.
Works? Isn't that
sort of suction or something.
So that way you can also put it back together again.
Well, the top, obviously you don't need the top. So we empty the eggshell with the egg out. We whisk it, and then we scramble it really, really whisking really fast the whole time we're cooking it. So lots of air gets involved. And it stays very light and fluffy, and then you... Don't cook it all the way quite yet, and then you spoon it back into the egg. And then you top the egg with a little lime creme fraiche that's been whisked. I can't even.
There we go.
And then on top of that, you put a nice spoon of caviar, white sturgeon caviar, which is the indigenous sturgeon from the Columbia River.
Okay,
yeah,
so that's a gelato too. Well, how about a last recipe that includes those wonderful mushrooms that made me a hero once? Because I went to Seattle lots of times, and
I must tell you, mushroom. This is probably the biggest place in the world to get mushrooms.
Exactly.
Here's what happened
Morales
to me.
My favorite.
I went to the Pike Place Market.
Uh-huh.
And I had carefully measured how much room I had in my suitcase. So it's almost like I went there with my hands apart saying, this is how much room I have. I want you to fill that space with morel mushrooms. It was a pound and a half altogether.
Yeah, those are
I brought them back, and I was a hero at home for at least a week.
Anne
absolutely adores them. We had morel mushrooms with everything.
And you can dry them. They dry so well,
uh-huh.
You know, the morel mushroom. One of my favorite morel recipe that we do here every spring, end of May, beginning of June, when the halibut season starts, we run a special a dish called baked Alaskan halibut with morel, ramps, and smoked bacon butter.
Oh wow!
Oh, sounds fabulous.
And
anything.
It's so good. It's page 131, and basically what you do is you take a salmon and you bake it in the oven on a buttered dish with a piece of parchment paper right on top. You put it in the oven and you bake it with just a little bit of wine or fish stock right around it. Put that in the oven that way. And then the morels are sauteed with Once they are like three-quarters sauteed with a lot of butter, you add the ramps that are sliced. The ramps are, by the way, you know what they are? They're the white.
Yeah, you can get them. They have a big celebration of them in West Virginia, just down the road from here.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. That's where a lot of them come from.
Right. Well, listen, Terry, we're having such a wonderful time here, but time is getting away from us, and I think we must let's have a last thought for our listeners before we say goodbye and stand the line.
One last thought: just go eat there. That's what I want to do.
Well, no, I'm gonna ask Terry to stay on the line after we go to a break so we can make a reservation.
Okay.
There we go.
And everybody, get this book and Rovers. Recipes from Seattle's Chef in the Hat by Thierry Rotureau, and it's wonderful.
And we also have a great website.
Go ahead.
Give
Rovers,
us the
rovers-seattle.com.
Okay. Do you have recipes on it?
Oh, yeah. We have I don't know if we have recipes on the website, but we have menus, wine list, and the whole history of Rovers, plus you can make reservations online.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, so
thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Terry.
We hope to see you soon. Thank you so much for joining us, and listeners, it's time to
now take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We have an old friend and just a beautiful person on the line, Emily Lucchetti. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you for having me.
And Emily's a very busy person, folks. She opened two restaurants last night. So if you want to know what it sounds like to open two restaurants last night, listen close to what Emily has to say. It's absolutely amazing she can even talk.
Well, what we're going to be talking about is actually this wonderful book, Classic Stars Desserts. And this is a compilation, as it says in the introduction, of a recipe. How many is it? 150?
About 150, yes.
Yes. Extracted from your first two your Stars cookbooks of desserts. Your favorite recipes. And the first two books, of course, are out of print, so now people can have a second chance at getting these yummy recipes from you.
Right, and it's interesting because even though the first books were published in 1991 and 1994, they're still often the ones that I go back to when it's like I'm going to be at home and I want to make something simple for people to come over or whatever. I go back to those books and say, because they're the ones that are really so close to my heart, but I've been making them for 20 years and I continue to make them.
You know, you mean you actually have to go back to read the recipe book?
Yeah, well, I don't need to read it for the method. I need to read it for the numbers of like a half a cup of this, a quarter cup of this, because, you know, people say, well, can't you remember the recipes? And the problem is I just have so many numbers of recipes in my head, I don't remember if the third of a cup goes with the cinnamon pastry cream or the whatever, you know, so you do get kind of short-circuited.
Sure, and all kinds of pastry chefs have told us how important it is to get the quantities just right.
Yes, exactly.
You can't cheat and make it up by adjusting it as it goes along. If you get it wrong, you'll have a failure.
Right, that's exactly right. And, you know, it's interesting, too, with recipes. So many people get nervous when there's a recipe. And I say, don't get nervous. It's there to help you. It's there as a guideline. It's there to make you successful. It's not there like, you know, an instruction manual for putting a bicycle together or something like that, or putting your computer together that, you know, you look at and they're written in, you know, German or, you know,
right.
Arabic or something just because they're so complicated.
Now, explain your style. Emily, I mean, you have a good grasp of exactly what your style is. I mean, more than anybody I've ever known, actually.
Well, that's interesting because, I would say my style is I like things very straightforward, and I like them very homey, but I like to give them a little bit of a twist, and so it makes them a little bit more elegant, a little bit more refined.
Yeah, they're also beautiful.
Yeah, and they have to be beautiful, but I don't want desserts to be so esoteric that you look at it and it's kind of a thing of art. You want to look at it and say, oh my gosh, that looks so good, I just want to dig right in and eat it. You know, it's not like, oh, I don't want to destroy this beautiful picture.
Isn't that the truth? I mean, it's horrible being presented with one of these things and you have no idea how to attack it.
Yeah, and also, you know, sometimes you look at those, and it looks like someone's put more time and attention than putting the plate together than the care and love of making it, you know, taste really good. And when you look at a dessert, you just, it should look like it's going to taste good, not that it's been fiddled with or, you know, it's got all these garnishes. And often chefs, pastry chefs, will put garnishes on a dessert just to make it look better. And my attitude is that it has to be on the plate for the reason of making the dessert taste better. If it's not adding to the overall flavor, then leave it off the plate.
And you have another hallmark or trademark is that you like collaborative efforts. I mean, working with your pastry cooks and getting ideas.
Mm-hmm, I love it because, you know, when you're working, you know, you can create a good dessert, you know, sometimes by yourself, but often I'll have a germ of an idea and I'll say to my pastry cooks, okay, you know, here's an idea. Let's do, you know, caramel with coconut. But okay, now that I have this idea, what can I do with it? Or you'll come up with a great flavor and it's like, you know, how am I going to present it? And here's a funny recipe we were working on for the opening of Water Bar that opened last night. I wanted to do something with pineapple because, you know, in the winter there's not that much fruit around, and I really needed a tart to balance it out. So I balance out the menu. So I tried a whole bunch of different things, and finally, after about 3 weeks of trying, and I tried a brown butter filling, but then it was too sweet, and, you know, you're just kind of going back and forth and back and forth, and one of my pastry cooks said, well, why don't we try, you know, a creme fraiche custard with it?
Oh, that's
and,
great.
And we did a creme fraiche custard, and it just, you know, woke the dessert up, and now, you know, it was the hardest of all the desserts on the menu to put together and create, but we put it out there, and everyone's like, oh, my favorite's the pineapple tart, so it was worth the wait. Because sometimes when you're creating desserts, you just want to give up. You know, you're tasting and you say, do I like this because it's good, or do I like this just because I'm really tired of working on it and I just want it to be over with?
Now, tell us, just run through the restaurants that you're actually involved with. And your role is through Pat Coletto's group. Is that what's going on?
Yes. Well, Pat Coletto has so many different restaurants. I'm not involved with all of them. But at Stars Restaurant, I worked with a chef named Mark Franz for 20 years.
He's Mark was the one you worked with.
Yeah. Okay. So he's like my second husband. And so when he got involved with Pat at Farallon, I said, you know, I'm on board. And so then when Pat and Mark did Nick's Cove, and now that we're doing Water Bar, I said, you know, put me on for all three of them. And so at the Stars years, I was, you know, as I say, happily chained to the pastry table, and I was doing all the production myself and that kind of thing. But one, as I've gotten older, and two, as you get more restaurants, you just can't physically be in all places
right.
at all time. And I just, we have a great team of people that work at all the restaurants, and, you know, and I stop by, you know, I talk to them on the phone all the time, plus I go by and, you know, see them. Luckily, they're all in the same city, so I can hit,
right.
you know, three restaurants several times during the week. So.
Well, you won't hit Nick's Cove three or four times a week.
That's actually a little bit
of a step away.
Yeah, well, Nick's Cove being out in Tamales Bay, you know, out on Route 1 near Point Reyes, it's so beautiful out there that I often will go out there and spend the night. I'll go out midweek and just plan it so I can spend the night.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's great, too, is each one of the restaurants, the desserts are a little bit different. I mean, as you know, you've been to Nick's Cove, and it's more of a roadhouse, so the desserts are really simple. Like now on the menu, we have a carrot cake, and we have a chocolate pudding, and just real simple, basic things like that. And Farallon is probably the other extreme, where it's a little bit fancier. The desserts are a bit more complex, and I'd say Water Bar kind of fits somewhere in the middle. You know,
Okay. If
you go and you look at a lot of Australian magazines, food magazines, and books, their style is so much like my style. It's amazing.
We're just heading out there. We're gonna be there for a month.
Oh my gosh, I'm so jealous.
Yeah,
they have in Australia, they have such great product like we do in the United States, especially in California. And the presentation of the desserts is kind of.
What are your favorite places there? Because we used to live there and we go back frequently. But are you that familiar with the restaurants? I mean, is there some special dessert place?
I haven't been there in a long time, but
there was that Nazi lady. Who was she?
I do look at all the Australian food magazines, and I have one that was like from December with all the best restaurants of Melbourne.
Oh, really?
So if you want, I can actually, I'll either fax it or I'll mail you a copy.
That would be great. Terrific.
Yeah, because I remember when the first time I ever went to Australia was in 1987, and at Stars, Jeremiah Tower and some of the chefs and myself went down to the Regent Hotel in Sydney and did Stars food for 2 weeks.
Oh, nice.
And that was great. I mean, I didn't leave the hotel for the first 2 weeks, but the second 2 weeks, my husband came down and we traveled all over and just ate tons of food. And it was just, just seeing, you know, the local mascarpone and the products, the food products are just amazing.
Well, Peter's cousin.
The food scene must have been starting to change then. I mean, I lived there in the 60s and early 70s. And the cuisine was French, or it was English, or if you were lucky, it was seafood cooked really rather simply. But there certainly wasn't anything like a modern Australian cuisine.
Now you
fast forward 35 years, and you absolutely have a great dining scene. And our favorite place in Melbourne is Donovan's. Donovan's at the beach in St Kilda.
Oh,
is,
yeah.
Is our favorite place, and Gail Donovan is an old friend and somebody who travels the world sort of like you do.
She's a great sense of humor.
Yeah, it just makes me it was funny. My husband went on a business trip in December to Australia, and he was there for 2.5 weeks, and I couldn't go because I had a 5-minute television spot in Fresno
It's
not that I, you know, I have wanted to honor my responsibilities and everything, but it's like, oh,
that's,
I'm missing a 2.5 week trip to free trip to Australia in the height of summer, you know, in the height of berry season, you know, in the height of their fruit season. And I think too, what I love about them is what they do and how with fruit, because so many people in the United States, pastry chefs, they mask the fruit flavor. I mean, when you know you hold some great strawberries or a great peach or a pear or whatever in your hand, you know all the work's already been done for you. If you eat that by itself, that's a meal or a dessert or whatever.
See, that's another one of your hallmarks.
Yeah,
clarity of flavor.
Yeah, and you don't want to ruin that flavor. You want to somehow make it better, and you can't mask it by disguising it. You can't mask it by making it too sweet where you can't taste the essence of the fruit. So, and I think that's one thing that I really try to strive and kind of do in the Australian type of way is just honor that, because it's, you know, nature has given us such a gift.
See, that's why they don't sell frozen strawberries.
That's an old story, that's a
famous story, Emily. It's actually worth telling on the air, because Anne came out to Australia in 1972.
I think we've done this. Let's not do this again.
She wanted to make a strawberry pie because we were having some people over for dinner and then we were going to play bridge. So she went off to the supermarket, knowing what the recipe was for strawberry pie, to find frozen strawberries so she could put the frozen strawberries under the fresh ones. And they have no such product.
That's funny. Well, you know, when I go to the East Coast to teach and things like that, you can't buy, at least in Massachusetts where I've looked, you can't buy frozen blackberries. They're all in a medley mixed with blueberries and raspberries.
Oh, funny.
You know, in California you can get them all separate. So I don't know. I just thought that was very strange.
Well, Emily, what do you think about this trend that of sort of raiding the other side? Because you've been on both sides of the kitchen. You've been on the culinary side and on the pastry side. What do you think of this current trend of fusing them together?
You know, I think I'm just more old-fashioned in my approach. I don't want a rosemary creme brulee. It just does nothing for me, you know. And I also think when you eat dessert, it's at the end of the meal. You don't want, I mean, you want something that tastes really good, but you don't want something too adventurous or too out there, because you're trying to close down your taste buds. You're trying to end the meal and, you know, finish things off. And I think that sometimes you just want something to be much more simple. And I just am not, you know, I just am much more kind of traditional in my, what I want for desserts. And it's funny, too, I'm actually at the point where I like, my favorite time to have a dessert or something is more like 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh, yeah, that's your low energy point.
Yeah, and also you haven't had a meal, and so your taste buds are very sharp. You know, they're really ready for something delicious. And you can have it where sometimes if I've had a salad and a piece of fish or a piece of meat or whatever, it's like, you know, I've kind of been distracted and I can't really focus in on that dessert. So it's like I almost appreciate it more if I have it when I haven't had anything else beforehand.
Right. So.
It's funny. We've had a conversation with some other guests, though, about the possibility of all dessert restaurants.
What do you think about that?
There is at least one that we know of. We've been to Pong. In Barcelona. Well, Pong pretends that it has
savory things
on the menu.
The thing that I actually like about Pong is that Pichet has a wonderful approach to savory food. Because I think it's funny with pastry chefs, if you go to their house for dinner, or, you know, because I know a lot of pastry chefs, their savory food is very clean and it's very light. And so I always find that kind of interesting. I think the all pastry restaurants, I mean, for instance, in New York, there's that place called Chickalicious, and you can go for dessert and stuff. It works in New York because it's, one, it's a huge city, and two, it's a late night city. You know, in San Francisco, it's, you know, people go to bed pretty early, and it's not that big. So I think for the dessert things to work, you really have to have a place where they can go for a meal, you know, somewhere, and then go to a Chickalicious for dessert. You know, as being a pastry chef and being surrounded by sugar all day, you need the soup, you need the salad, you need the food, because you just can't survive.
Now, you're a lover of chocolate. This must be a good time for you, because you're a lover of the bittersweet chocolate, and that's what's in vogue now.
Yeah, and it's funny because people still get confused when they see bittersweet, that they think that it doesn't have any sugar in it, which, as you know, is just not true. That's unsweetened. A lot of the semi-sweet chocolate to me is just too sweet, and not only does it not taste as chocolatey and rich, it just ends up being too, you know, sugary. There are, you know, exceptions to that, like Scharfenberger, for instance, makes a really good semi-sweet, but it's got more chocolate in it than, you know, most other semi-sweets. So I always say it's bittersweet just is like semi-sweet with some salt. It really just has much more of an essence of flavor.
Yeah, well, we've interviewed so many chocolatiers lately, and people are producing the most amazing chocolate.
Yeah, it is. It's gone over the edge, and you laugh because, you know, everyone now has rationalized that they're eating it, you know, for their health and stuff. And it's like, yeah, well, that's 1 ounce a day. That's not, you know, a whole new category.
So what's next? You're finished opening restaurants?
Yeah, well, I think these are going to keep me busy for a little while. I'm trying to kind of think about writing another book. I haven't decided exactly what the subject is. It's, you know, books are, in a good way, are a lot of work, but you kind of have to toss around a bunch of subjects in your head and stew on them for several months to really own it and get excited about it, so then you can jump in and do all that boring recipe testing and stuff like that. What really gets me going on a book, I think, is when, like, I'll do a couple recipes, like, for instance, this pineapple tart that I was talking about, is that it was like, oh, this is so good, I have to share it with other people, you know, because it's just so good. So it's like, okay, here's one recipe for the book, and then you just kind of go from there.
Oh, dear. Well, this one is a great one, and it's on our website, and anybody can go to www.onthemenuradio.com.
We better double-check and see if the webmaster put it up there.
Yeah, well, we better put it up there.
If it's not there, it's going to be there very soon, this afternoon.
OTM bookshelf, and just click right through and buy this. And it's certainly an important addition to the book collection interested.
Listen, before we go.
And actually, I have to now, Peter had never heard of apple pan dowdy, so I'm going to have to actually bake. I don't bake.
What's a pan dowdy? I don't know what it sounds like. It doesn't sound like.
It's all that matters is it's good.
Doesn't sound a lot like a dessert. One of the interesting things, one of the additions, because even though this is in a sense a reprinting of recipes that have been out there, and people have copies of these books worn in their kitchen from several years ago before they sold out, is that one of your sommelier friends did a commentary on what wines to put with dessert.
Right.
You want to comment just briefly about that?
Yeah, Peter Palmer is a sommelier at Fairlawn Restaurant, and he is a great, great guy because he can talk to people about wine in a very approachable manner, and he's just so enthusiastic. And when people get around dessert wine, they really don't know what to have, and they're very confused. And so what Peter did was put a whole section together about dessert wines, explaining all the types of dessert wines, and then we said, okay, these are the wines, this is what which ones would go with which dessert. So it really is very informative. And I read it, and it was like, even though he's taught me so much, it was like I learned stuff that I didn't even know.
Okay. Now, tell me, now, Emily, so you and Peter sat down, and you tasted every one of the desserts with every one of the wines just to make sure you got them exactly
right?
Well,
you know what's really interesting, what we do at the restaurant is sometimes we'll, like, plate all the desserts on the menu, and then we'll bring out 6 or 7 dessert wines and try them all together. And some of them you get the most terrible combinations in the world, and it's like you don't want to do that. And some work so-so, and some are just, like, blow your socks off because they're so delicious.
So you do that
yeah.
quite regularly.
And it's, you know, I get paid to do it too, so it's like I'm not going to argue.
What's it? Getting paid to eat dessert and drink wine.
What a terrible
thing to do.
Someone has to do it.
Wow. It's a tough job.
Yeah. Okay. When are we going to catch up with you next? I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, I hope it won't be too long after your trip to Australia.
Well, we have to, there are enough new things in San Francisco already, even though we were there as recently as last July.
Yeah. There's tons of things.
We definitely have to come out.
Yeah,
again.
It's amazing.
You have to come out when it's March in Pittsburgh and the weather's pretty still cold and windy and rainy. Come out to San Francisco where we'll have spring.
That's great.
I will come out when it's real fall. We've been there in October too, and that's a very nice time of the year.
Yeah, that's a beautiful time too.
And July with the fog is always a bit of an issue, I guess.
Yes. It's good eating weather though.
Yeah. that's a good time. It's always good eating weather.
Yeah.
So it's always a good time to eat desserts, whether it's apple pan dowdy or whatever else it might be.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Well, Emily, thank you so much for talking to us, and looking forward to seeing you soon. And good luck on your new restaurants.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Great.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Before we take a break, we forgot the good housekeeping at the beginning of the session. We forgot to remind people to come to www.onthemenuradio.com to check out all the other things we've assembled there for them, and also to send us emails at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com.
Right.
And now it's time to
take a break.
So we'll take one and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're moving into an exciting cocktail segment next. We have on the phone Tyler Field III, the third of us, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, who's Vice President of Wine and Spirits for Morton's Restaurant Group. Well, welcome, Tyler. What a great job.
Do I get to welcome, too?
Yes, welcome,
Yeah, I forgot it. It's always nice to have that left-out feeling.
Well, I welcomed you 2 segments
ago. Oh, you did? Yeah. I mean, that's all the welcome I get.
Yes. Okay, so here we are with Tyler, and we're going to talk about, I mean, cocktails are big-time business these days now, right?
Yeah, very, very much so. Anything that can be had and perceived as a luxury without costing hundreds of dollars is a very popular commodity in the world we live in right now, especially in the restaurant business.
But this is not the first time, Tyler. I remember when shortly after Morton's opened, you were bringing back the martini,
yep.
And we greatly enjoyed that.
Well, and we still have the best, biggest, and coldest ones around, I promise you.
But there's something so this new wave is a little bit different.
Right. Well, I think the actual word or the term martini has morphed into what we perceive being that classical martini of that beautiful gin, maybe a hint of vermouth, and a great olive. Now, a martini can be mixed with a variety of juices, colors, fruits, vegetables, and there's a lot of different preparations, and that word has been taken to a new level, and it's what we're seeing now is a real, almost like the chef culture that the Food Network brought us. There's now a bar chef culture. you actually have people in the world now that are master mixologists. They're, you know, they're bar chefs. It's a whole subculture of people that want to bring these amazing tactile aromatic experiences to people that are having a drink.
But now, isn't there a limit? Don't you think that at the point where you start using a spoon for your cocktail, don't you think maybe we've gone a little bit too far?
Yeah, I think if you have to eat your cocktail, it's not a cocktail anymore. I mean, it might be a shrimp cocktail.
No, this is this is a chocolatini, I think.
Yeah.
We saw her eating
it. I'm greatly relieved to say it was not at Morton's. I'm sure you would never do such a disgraceful thing.
No. If you have to eat it, I think you're in trouble. But if you have to drink it, I think you should be treated to different textures, and you should be treated to a visual experience, and I think you should be treated to, you know, something that also smells wonderful.
Well, give us an example. Maybe we should ask you to explain. You have an entirely new bar concept and menu at Morton's.
Yeah, two or three years ago, we took our bar, which we had always had at Morton's. It was a very dark, classic men's club type feel bar that really complemented the dining room very well. But we thought, you know what? We need to brighten this up. We need to make our bar a destination unto itself. And there's a whole new generation of people. I mean, we have the baby boomers, which I'm a part of. And that's now a big part of, you know, who's in our dining room. But then the Gen Xers and then the new ones behind them, the millennials, are actually a bigger chunk of people that can actually buy alcoholic beverages than the baby boomers are. And we have to be able to draw these people in and give them a Morton's experience and realize as well that they might not be able to have a $150 experience in the dining room all the time, and not that anybody could do that, but we want them to be able to have a quality experience with delicious cocktails, and we also implemented a bar menu in the bar. So you can, you know, it creates increased trial for us, and it also increases, you know, our demographic base. So it was a very key idea for us and one of our major, you know, growth initiatives over the next, you know, 5 or 10 years, and we'll continue, and it's been exceptionally successful.
Have you redone the bar?
Yeah, we go in and we completely redo it.
I have to check that out.
Well, we've done it recently in Pittsburgh. I think it was about a year ago, and it's really brightening it, putting in more feminine fabrics on the different banquettes and then the bar stools, and having a much more comfortable feel for women. I mean, as well as you know, create more, you know, put in the flat screen TVs and make it contemporary. I mean, Morton's, we love to be very 1978, and that's who we are. But you know, in the bar scene, we needed to create some buzz. We need to make it electric, and we needed to bring in a younger clientele to enjoy Morton's as well.
I think the last time we were in Morton's is when you were doing that world's largest bottle of wine thing with Behringer.
Yes, that's correct.
And I think that might have been the last time we were there. So the bar was still the same. That's probably a couple of years ago now.
Yeah, you're going to need to come in again because it's very, very different. And Diane sports a completely new uniform, and we changed those as
well. What is Diane wearing?
No. It's very tasteful, but it's, you know, a gold vest, and it used to be, you know, black and you know, and very staid. And we kind of, you know, brought it up to hopefully to be contemporary and fun.
I was expecting Diane in a semi-bunny uniform.
I don't think
so. No, absolutely not.
Listeners, I mean, we let you in on the secret. Our very favorite bartender in the whole world is a woman who's just absolutely superb. She's been at Morton's in Pittsburgh since the very opening, and her name is Diane Porter. And I just didn't see her quite in anything.
No, not at all. But
nothing undignified.
It was more of a color change. We're certainly turning into a Las Vegas nightclub or anything like that.
So anyhow, so you have now this a whole new range of. You're the only ones that I was interviewing that actually are doing the more experimental things in outposts, not main cities.
Correct. We started with these bars coming up with programming that would be cutting edge and new. And one of the first things we did is we reached out to a gentleman named Francesco Lifranconi, and he is a master mixologist out of
Francesco?
Francesco Lifranconi.
Lifranconi, okay.
Mm-hmm. And he's out of Las Vegas, Nevada. He works for a company there called Southern Wine and Spirits, but originally he was from Italy and participated in the World Bartending Championships out of London and is one of the preeminent people in the cocktail world, which I get to spend some time in, for creativity and making dynamic and incredible drinks. So we got together with him and we said, Francesco, we obviously are famous for martinis. What's the martini of the future? What is the most delicious, you know, contemporary style of martini that you can come up with? And we left him alone for a couple of months and we flew out and looked at these creations, and he created these amazing different drinks. The one that we currently are going with and we've made a style out of is ones that use foam, and he uses a he'll make a martini or a cosmopolitan or a caipirinha or anything like that can be served up, and then he'll top it with a proprietary foam which is seasonal. And right now for the winter we have a foam with cinnamon liqueur, fresh pear puree, and fresh lemon juice in it, and that will top, you know, your cosmopolitan and your caipirinha or different of what we call the heavenly cocktails that we serve. And
oh, that's right, you call them heavenly cocktails.
That we call them heavenly martinis. We've actually registered for trademark. Instead of using the word martini, we've coined the word Morton's Mortini, M-O-R-T. Anyway, we've trademarked that, and these are part of that collection.
But you wouldn't put this on top of a real martini.
No.
Oh, thank goodness for that.
I wouldn't do that either. No, and it's these are strictly specialty drinks, and they look beautiful, they taste beautiful, and again, you're giving a person two different textures in one cocktail, and they've been an absolute hit around the world for us. And so we're now developing, you know, what's next.
And what about for summer? What would you be doing?
Well, we're looking at different foams with more, we're looking at one perhaps with a raspberry component to it, because that's kind of a summer, or a strawberry, any of those kind of summer northeastern fruits that you can find in the wild.
Okay.
We're looking at that right now. And then, you know, before we were using passion fruit last summer as our base, and so you'll have that as well. We use passion fruit with Grand Marnier. It was delicious as well. So we'll keep up with that. And then, you know, trends for the future, we just added a caipirinha, which is cachaça. It's very hot from Brazil.
Right.
The Brazilian
sugar cane. It's hot, right, yeah.
And then we haven't seen this yet, but I think there's a lot of buzz now, and you see a couple of places going in Vegas coming back to absinthe and creating absinthe bars.
Yeah, it's now legal.
Yeah, now it's cleaned up. Now it doesn't actually kill you a little
bit.
It
doesn't kill you anymore. Yeah. And I think there's one or two people now that have been given the right to distribute a legal version of absinthe right now.
Yeah.
It's just starting to make some waves and to get some legs. So we might see that in the next 5 years.
You know, it's not made from wormwood anymore?
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
But there was one very unpleasant ingredient. There was the ingredient that was actually poisonous.
I know, it made you go blind.
And they took that out.
And it made you go crazy.
Now there's a trend there's another trend that we've seen, Tyler, that you haven't mentioned yet, which is the use of what people are calling botanicals.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
So they're not just gins and vodkas with unusual botanicals like Hendrick's, which has
right.
cucumber in it, or
sure.
or any of the other rather unusual
right.
ones, which are a whole lot of fun, but also adding herbs into the drink itself. And the leading exponent we've come across there calls himself a bartender, not a bar chef, and his name is Scott Beattie, and he's in a restaurant called Cyrus.
Mm-hmm.
In Healdsburg, California.
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing some wonderful things with fresh fruit, just pick fresh fruit.
And veggies.
But also putting things that would ordinarily be classed as herbs in the drinks, not the sweet ones.
No, we have one at Morton's as well. I mean, that, the herbal influence is alive and well, and we do a thyme lemon drop, and we take fresh thyme, and we muddle it with homemade simple syrup and fresh lemon juice and actually limoncello and a little bit of vodka, and shake it. And on the top, you'll get the crystallized ice, but you also get just teeny tiny pieces of the thyme. But it really resonates in the drink. It's delicious.
And Diane says that she proved to somebody that it also makes a good perfume.
But you're absolutely right. That's going to continue. There's also people are making now different types of herbal simple syrups, you know, to add to different drinks.
And you do all this fresh, right on site, in your
correct boards. On site. One of the things you're seeing, especially in the upscale, is fresh ingredients à la minute, because you can't, you know, if you're going to squeeze your own lime juice or you're going to squeeze your own orange juice, the shelf life on that is about 7 hours if you're lucky.
Oh, really?
And so one of the choices that, you know, major restaurant groups or large volume places make is they like to batch everything, but the expense of batching fresh juices is very, very expensive. So a lot of times you'll find high-quality substitutes, and the only way to compete with that is to make it per drink, a la minute.
Huh.
And that's what we do. So we have these little fruit pressers, hand pressers, and so when you order a margarita from us, you're getting fresh fruit right then, not out of a jug or pre-made.
Oh, that sounds great. I mean, that requires a certain amount of speed and dexterity on the part of the bartender.
The bartender, absolutely, and it adds
so that people don't have to wait.
Yeah, I don't think we're too far away from going into a bar where they're going to make your drinks table side. I think that's kind of the next generation.
Now, back to the food side of this.
Sure.
Because you said you're stressing bar food as well. Now it seems to me that some of these rather sweet flavored martinis can't really be very food friendly unless you're having dessert with them. How do you deal with that?
Well, as far as pairing alcohol with food, we don't. With wine, yes. We spend a lot of time actively doing that. We've done vodka dinners before, but again, we're not putting a lot of fruit flavors with it. And
okay,
to answer your question, if a person has a cosmopolitan and they were to ask, you know, what should I have, you know, with that to enjoy, we don't really have a program in place to say that, you know, exactly what that is. And we're certainly, you know, not going to say, well, that wouldn't be a good choice or, you know, whatever.
Well, the people at Taylor's in Manhattan, that's one of their specialties, but they cross over sweet and savory all the time.
Yeah, right? because the
Sam
chef,
Mason
yeah,
is
Sam,
a,
Sam's,
is
a Sam's a pastry chef.
Yeah.
So and not only that, he was used to working with that wonderful Eben, what was his last name?
Eben Freeman, who's
Eben Freeman, who was at WD-50, and he's now at Taylor. So
great restaurant.
He's another name to watch, Eben Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
He's got some... He's got some magic in his formulation.
Yeah, he's the one who's doing the solid drinks, the solid cocktails. Actually.
Solid cocktails.
Yeah.
The solid ones.
He's doing the ones
with the gelatin.
Yeah.
So what do you have to do? You have to be patient.
Or do you just
clip off a piece if you're thirsty?
I think they are.
Believe it or not, that was from France, probably from the 40s. They would do that when they were creating cocktails for meals. So it's everything's coming back again.
They used to gel the cocktails.
Mm-hmm. They would gel like pieces of fruit, and they put it in the champagne so it would float.
Oh, yeah.
And they would put it in, like, ice cube trays, and you put gelatin, and you put fresh raspberries, and it would float as a garnish, and then slowly the champagne would take away the gel, and then you'd be left with the fruit.
Funny. Oh, so much. We had somebody on with the business of spirits
mm-hmm.
we interviewed, and it's amazing how much has come back.
Noah Rothbaum, I think.
Yeah,
one
Noah
of the,
Rothbaum.
One of the neat ingredients I just found, too, is we were working on our margaritas, and the agave, which they make the tequila from, you can buy agave nectar.
Which is honey,
now we use that. And you're seeing a lot of that, too, where people are, if they're using ingredients from where things come from, you know, to complete the drink.
Yeah, let's give you a couple of tips on agave that you might not have come across. We have an interview coming up very shortly mm-hmm. with a company which makes Q Tonic.
Q Q-Tonic.
Q-Tonic. It's at, I think it's somewhere out of Brooklyn or somewhere like that.
Yeah. And that's the next big question, and it's tonic
water. It's a fresh picked quinine from Peru, or quinine as I would call it in English,
right.
Sweetened with agave rather than with high fructose corn syrup or cane sugar or anything like that.
Right.
And comes in the cutest bottle, in a bottle that would absolutely suit Morton's. It's so decorative.
It'll probably do well.
So if you haven't seen that yet, I think you ought to
look for.
It's called Q. It's called Q Tonic.
Okay.
Just the letter Q.
It's made like around Maryland or something.
Oh, is it Maryland?
Okay. It's someplace in the Mid Atlantic.
Okay, I'm mistaken. Yeah. I thought it was. I'm getting mixed up with the ketchup.
Is it for a highball or is it on the rocks?
No, it's for a gin and tonic.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you, the other fascinating one was that what's the upscale soda?
Oh, dry soda.
Dry soda.
That's also good.
Dry soda for those people who like to pretend they have a sophisticated drink, but for whatever reason they're not having any alcohol.
She was pregnant when she hit on the fact she couldn't find anything she liked.
And these are similarly.
It's called dry soda.
Dry soda.
Dry soda.
And they're bottles that you'd be proud to have.
Yeah, they've won awards for design of their bottles.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for letting me learn today.
We talked to a lot of people.
Yeah, when you sit there like we do all day long, trying to keep up with the latest thing that's going on, it's hard to miss, we've taken over all your knowledge.
Oh, no.
So now we're going to be telling all kinds of people about Mortinis.
Thank you very much.
So it's a good job you got it trademarked already.
Thank you.
Yeah. I just read something about mood heaters, where you go on a website and you answer four or five questions, and they determine what mood you're in, and therefore they have a mojito that matches it.
That sounds like a really good idea.
Right.
Yeah, but you could have a classic martini that would deal with every mood you possibly exist.
Bring us your moods, we'll give you a cocktail. That's fine. Diane will help you with your mood.
I have to go see Diane.
Bring back the Manhattan too.
Yeah. And rye, yeah. Well, listen, Tyler, this has been really wonderful, and I'm glad that you picked up on this to do the interview with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, and thank you so much.
And, and good luck, and enjoy Australia, since you said you're going there.
Yep.
And we'll give
yeah,
you...
Yeah, I look forward if you could send me some great places, some tips from on your journey when you get back in March. I'd really appreciate it.
Start tuning in from the third week in March, and you'll be able to follow in our footsteps all around the country.
Perfect.
And we've had so much fun again, as usual.
Yes, that's going to wrap up another program.
Time flies when you're having fun, as my mother used to say.
Yes, and so I think that'll do it for today. And
that'll do it for today. So
listeners,
bye. So goodbye, Tyler.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye, Tyler. Great good fortune with your new cocktail program at Morton's. And listeners, we'll see you next week.
Exactly.
Same time, same place at www.onthemenuradio.com.
Bye-bye.